My final guest for today's podcast is Kaylee Myers, the executive director of the National Indian Justice Center based in Santa Rosa, California. Kelly, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
I've been reflecting a lot on this podcast. As you and I have discussed, it's something that is very near to my heart as a researcher and a journalist who cares about issues of equity and is tuned in to the importance of transportation systems in providing access and mobility. I think back to a tour I took of the Tohono O'odham Nation in Arizona. I was visiting tribal schools, and I was absolutely floored when I learned that it was a common, if not daily, practice for a lot of the students to hitchhike to get to and from school every day. And that's really when a shift occurred in my thinking about transportation. And I realized that transportation is the essence of social mobility. If you can't get where you need to go, you can't pursue opportunities. And if you can't get the things you need for your community, you're very likely dealing with a lot of challenging socioeconomic issues. So as I mentioned, I'm thrilled to have you speak in your capacity as somebody who thinks daily about what does justice mean. And I know that a lot of what you have focused on and your center has focused on over the last several decades has touched on transportation issues. So having said all of that, we know there is now very clear consensus that the TTAP program will be reconstituted. It looks like it will be a regional focus of some sort. What do you feel are the biggest lessons we can learn from the TTAP programs of the past? What should we make sure that we preserve in future iterations?
I think you hit it on the head when you noted that transportation and mobility generally are key factors for anyone to survive, much less thrive, in a community that might be rural and economically under the median or under poverty lines. And when we look at tribal communities throughout the U.S., the big key takeaway is that there are very few transit hubs that reach all the way out to tribal communities. Those are often filled by tribal transportation programs or other subsidized programs. And that's just to get you to the point where transit could then take you to an education center, alternative health centers. Tribes have Indian health clinics, but if you needed any sort of triage or emergency, you would have to go elsewhere to find it. And when we look at how the TTAP centers worked in the era that NIJC was administering the Western TTAP program, and that was 2010 onward, what you really have to look at is the variation among tribal communities. We have tribal communities that are rural and way beyond any sort of acceptable transportation routes. And what I mean by that is that the roads are oftentimes not maintained by the owners of the roads, which could be counties or state. And if they are under federal management, there may not be enough money for the tribes or the federal agencies to maintain those roads. So getting to and from the tribal communities is often a task, dangerous task in some instances. On the other end of the spectrum, we have communities that are very near large city centers, or at least close enough to be able to get transit or anything else if you didn't have a car or have access to somebody with a car. So when we look at the variation among the tribal communities, their transportation burdens, their issues and challenges surrounding transportation can vary. There are some fundamental aspects that you will see often, which is that there are very few pedestrian facilities in tribal communities. And by that, I mean that there are very few sidewalks or pathways along roads that make it easy for a pedestrian to travel. And of course, we're looking at a large population of children in most tribal communities. We have a large population under 21 in many tribal communities. And so that puts young people on the shoulders of roads that are often in need of maintenance, in need of even striping to make sure that the children who are walking those roads know where there is a safe place to walk, or they're actually walking in the ditches that are next to the roads, which can be just as hazardous. So when we look at the types of variations of needs, we start from very basic facilities all the way up to some more extravagant facilities for a lot of tribal communities, which may just be simply a bus stop that has shelter and lighting and a transit stop for a city bus route. There's a lot of variation in need that's out there. And so the big takeaway, I think, is you have to be able to work with tribes, to develop a needs assessment, to ask them about the needs that need to be addressed, and what priority those needs really are. How can we serve the tribal communities better? We can listen to them.
As you were talking, I was thinking about the value in planning circles of what's called participant observer research. And I couldn't help but think about, as you were talking about a needs assessment, this notion of making sure that policy and decision makers and state and federal funders have some sense of what it's like to walk in a tribal community member's shoes, some sense of what it's like to walk along those shoulders that aren't even striped properly, as you said. That, to me, might be one of the biggest challenges, is how to ensure that this grassroots feedback is incorporated and not superseded by a top-down administering of a future TTAP program. I know that's a fairly abstract idea, Kelly, but do you have any thoughts on how that kind of feedback could be codified and put squarely in front of decision makers as this program looks to be reconstituted?
You know, the codification would be difficult. There are some things that the law is just not designed to do. And one of them is to manage behaviors that are oftentimes shaped by stereotypical expectations. And in this case, data is incredibly important, but there is often a lack of data with respect to tribal roads and transportation issues. And that's why communication with tribes is very, very important. So as an example, we had a road safety assessment that was, or road safety audit, I believe is the title, was conducted by Federal Highway Administration at the La Jolla Indian Reservation in Southern California. And part of the process is to obtain data for the road over a 10-year period and take a look at the types of injuries, crash data, whether or not there were any fatalities that occurred on the road. And we had the data, Federal Highway pulled the data that it had, and there were just very, very few crashes on the road. In fact, I know that they were thinking that this was not going to be a very fruitful trip for them to come out and do the road safety audit. But on their way up to the tribal hall where we were waiting for them, they had to take a stop in several places in the road, and they were seeing signs of crashes all along what was essentially a rock cliff face on one side of the road and then the drop on the other side of the road. They ran a good 30 minutes late or so because they were seeing so much evidence of crashes. And yet when they got up there, they took a look at the data sets again, and none of these crashes had gotten on anybody's data set. They weren't part of CHP. They weren't part of the tribe's crash data collection. It was just happening all of the time. And the tribal people were very well aware of it. And we had people that were part of the community that were there, part of the emergency response teams that were there. And they explained that this road was so fast and had so little space for shoulders that the priority was to get people out alive. So if there was a crash, you were administering to people and their injuries first. If people were not hurt, they oftentimes left the scene of the crash, leaving debris in the roadway. Again, it was a two-lane state highway, very fast, curved areas with very little visual. So people were running into the debris. Same issue there. They would have rocks that would fall off of the walls of the roadway there. And so the tribe had to do what was necessary to try and maintain safety. you couldn't have told the folks who came from Federal Highway about these kinds of conditions because the data didn't support it. And these folks that came, they're great people. They've done a lot of work in tribal communities, but a road like this was something new. You don't often see a very curved two-lane state highway where high speeds are seen on the road running right through a tribal community. They even had the opportunity when we were doing observations in the field to see bikes that were coming up that road three and four at a time. There was no shoulder or no bike lane. There was just no space for it. And definitely they were heading into traffic areas where they couldn't be seen by cars that would be following right behind them. Sometimes you have to see it to believe it. You can capture those things on video and try and help people to understand it. But it is difficult to explain when the data is not there to support your initial concepts of what you expect to see out on these roads. And many times you don't expect to see roads like we have in Indian Country. We have roads where children are let off on the side of very fast highways, and then they have to cross the highway to get to a place where their family members can pick them up from the school bus. And that's just because there are no other alternative facilities or ways to drop off the kids. We run into that quite often. It's become sort of commonplace for the tribes to fall into a void where federal funding and different grants are concerned because they just don't fill in those linkage voids that we have between transit stops, and safety needs. So if there was a way to codify that, believe me, I would have put great effort into it. But most of the time we find ourselves taking a lot of pictures, getting people to come out to tribal communities before they make any assumptions. And if we can get the folks that are involved in grant making or developing the RFPs for grants to come out and see the kinds of challenges that tribes face in the field, that would probably be best. Many of the tribal people deal with those challenges for so long, they become commonplace. So when they're looking for alternatives or safety improvements, they tend to look towards things that they can do with the amount of funding available. But the large scale projects with turnout lanes and big areas for buses to pull over and provide safety areas for children to be picked up by their families, they oftentimes are way over the budgets for some of the grant projects that are out there.
Excellent points. You mentioned with your example that this was a state route, which means that this is not a private road. This is a road that in theory, like here in California, Pacific Coast Highway is a state route. Am I correct in my understanding that the road you were speaking of was a road that not only tribal community members, but conceivably any American driving through that part of the country could pass through, driving at a fast speed on that tight turn with all of those factors you mentioned?
Yes, and that's actually very common in a lot of tribal communities to have state and federal highways that really bisect the communities in many areas and oftentimes right through the heart of the community. There's no secret that we have a history, especially in our state, if not throughout the country, where large-scale state highways and federal highways were put in to divide communities and push certain communities out. Tribal communities actually have jurisdiction over the roads as they flow through those tribal communities. There is a definition of Indian Country that's been codified in Title 18, and it actually identifies specifically that right-of-ways passing through Indian reservations are in fact part of Indian Country. And so it becomes tribal burden, if you will, to try and figure out who's going to deal with maintenance concerns on those roads. When there is a case that happens due to an accident or some sort of activity, the jurisdiction question is always out there and it's disputed quite often in courts. And that's still very much a gray area. It tends to be under legal definition, jurisdiction of a tribe. But oftentimes the suits are between the tribes and a state or between two parties who have suffered some sort of accident on the road. So let's just put it this way. It's kind of up in the air when it's some matter or activity that a state agency, a tribal agency, or federal agency wants to control, such as right of way and any subcontractors possibly putting in utility lines, then they all want to assume control and manage what the activity will be. But if it's a liability issue, nobody wants jurisdiction because they don't want to have to deal with the outcome of court case. They don't want to disrupt jurisdictional entitlement. And they, of course, don't want to have to be the jurisdictional last resort that may have to deal with any liability concerns. It's one of those areas that people tend to shy away from. What we really need to do is have collaborative discussions about the kinds of activities that are occurring on these roads. The road in question, in the example that I gave you at La Jolla, actually had a number of motorcycle accidents on it. And of all things, the people who were driving the motorcycles were oftentimes wearing video cameras and taking the footage and posting their footage on the internet to show that they were doing what was essentially, in their mind, an advanced driving course for motorcycles. And many of the people who were driving the motorcycles and who crashed, they still posted the footage, but they might have been involved in the military. I'm saying might because we can't prove it. But there were video discussions or things that were in the videos that basically made it sound as if the driver of the motorcycle had to get clear of the crash immediately. Otherwise, they were going to get in trouble. So, yes, anybody can be on the roads. But oftentimes the control, the law enforcement, the management, and the maintenance of the roads can belong to multiple jurisdictions, which just slows the process down for getting anything done, getting any responses to safety issues. It's definitely an event that, or an area in which we need collaboration in order just to maintain basic safety precautions. As climate change continues to cause more disruptions on the roads between erosion, flooding, and fires, the maintenance of the roads is really increased in terms of activity. We're going to really need to talk among the jurisdictions as to who can bring the resources to bear to cover those maintenance tasks.
One thing that I've taken away from my discussions today is that the TTAPs of the future have got to be established in a way that better coordination across local, state, federal jurisdictions takes place because it's so convoluted. The other thing that I'm thinking of as you're talking is how to incorporate new technologies to serve as tools to help carry out a more equitable and just system. So two examples that come to mind, and I'd love to hear your thoughts. One is geospatial GIS, geographic information system paradigm. The idea that decision makers, instead of looking at a line item in a spreadsheet on crash safety, or not even seeing it at all because it didn't end up being recorded, see the result of geolocated data that ideally tribal transportation professionals and other members of the community could document and bring to the attention of decision makers so that they are then faced with a more ethical choice than an invisible lack of a consideration in that this road is dangerous. It's been documented. I can see a GIS rendering of it, and maybe there could be change or an improved response there. I don't know that, again, you know, to your point, it could be codified into law, but perhaps it could make it a more functional process. Rule number one in storytelling is show, don't tell. That might be a better way to show. The other thing I'm thinking about in terms of the maintenance issues you're talking about, the environmental issues, is are there possibilities that we could use ITS, intelligent transportation systems, smart cameras, microsensors to have more intelligent roadways, bridgeways that would be easier for understaffed tribal governments to oversee, easier for them to do asset management, that kind of thing. In summary, have you thought about some of the other technologies and how they could be helpful in the service of carrying out justice in the transportation field?
Yeah, yes to both of those prospects. So on the first issue of GIS, tribes are already using GIS quite regularly throughout the country, particularly with transportation, but they use it in a wealth of other scenarios as well. I think with transportation, however, GIS is not only just a technological tool, it is also a safety tool. So for example, instead of having the folks in La Jolla's emergency response team having to stop and map out where all the debris is, they could set up the laser pointers and actually put the coordinates in so that then they could establish times in which they would have to go out and do cleanup or pull those things off of the roadway when, you know, or work with Caltrans to do it, which is the normal protocol, is you have to have a Caltrans team out there to do that cleanup, but they often cannot come right away. So if they had those data coordinates, it could really facilitate those types of processes. So the GIS is here to stay, I believe, with regards to tribal transportation. The new inventory system will be GIS-based soon. I have to give credit where credit's due to the tribal GIS organization that is run by Garrett Couch. The team that they have there, they've just done amazing work in terms of their time and effort and getting tribes well-versed in GIS and working with Esri directly through the tribal program that BIA funded for a while for that software. With the smart technologies that you're talking about, I think there's a lot of applications for it. And I do think starting with planning would be a great way of being able to put a visual in certain areas to get pictures and to bring data in without having to deploy a team. I think it builds a great pipeline for tribal youth as well. We have had GIS training for tribal youth. They take to it very well, much faster than I did. I think the smart tools could be the same way. If you could get kids to do evaluations and assessments of environmental concerns, plants, erosion, looking at conditions of roads after disasters without having to actually be out in the toxic area and pull in that data, whether it's through pictures or through measurements, I think we'll be building a great pipeline for our kids into technology sectors in the future. It would be great to have something a little bit more technology advanced than what we currently have, which tribes really still even have a difficult time finding, are just the simple tools to do the vehicle miles traveled, those kinds of things. Tribes have had to go to using video on phones and standing out there all of the time, as opposed to having the counters that, you know, they can watch and click and see if they can identify if people are doing seatbelts and how many people are ingress and egress into the community. You know, there's just more technologically advanced ways to do that. And our surrounding jurisdictions oftentimes will have those kinds of resources, or if they don't, the tribes and the surrounding jurisdictions could really collaborate on using those resources in a shared fashion. But again, that really all boils down to somebody having the time and the resources to obtain those materials and then having a good relationship with the people in the surrounding jurisdiction and building on those relationships. And in California, that's been a big mountain to climb, if you will. We have a few counties that are doing great work with the tribes in their counties. San Diego County is a great example. Sandag and the tribes in San Diego County have built a foundation of partnership and respect and have engaged in collaborative planning, collaborative projects. They've really done well. And we've had other communities where they're still trying to open the doors just to have a discussion about how we are using the roads in and out of tribal communities, that they're not just tribal people going on those roads, that it is of interest to the surrounding jurisdictions. We'll see where those relationships go in the future.
So when we look to the future of tribal technical assistance, it seems to me that the exemplars, like the great cooperation we're seeing between SANDAG, the municipal planning organization in San Diego County, with the tribes would be something to look at for leaders around the country to factor in as the new priorities are identified for the TTAPs of the future. It seems that technology is something that you and many other subject matter experts in this field agree on. However, it's one thing to have the technologies, and it's another thing to have the workforce that knows how to use it. I like very much the idea that you raised about training the next generation, because what that does is it builds a career pathway talent pipeline element into tribal technical assistance. Because as we all know, succession planning is another critical thing we need to think about. Some of the expertise, I argue, way too much of it is tucked away in the baby boomer generations, and that's not going to be around forever. So I feel like in this discussion we're having, Kelly, a lot of the elements that need to be at play in a TTAP of the future are emerging. I suppose I'd like to close, you know, my exploration today on tribal technical assistance and how it can play a role in ensuring and cultivating equity and mobility in tribal communities around the country by asking you, what would be your top recommendations for a TTAP of the future? What do you think the biggest, say, top three priorities ought to be for a newly reconstituted TTAP program?
I think the very first priority is that needs assessments will have to be done immediately. That should be the starting point. And a needs assessment for Indian Country should not just simply be a survey that's distributed out to all of the different points of contact that you may have for a certain tribe, but it really does mean phone calls to discuss with tribal transportation personnel what their greatest challenges are at the moment. And the reason why that is such a priority is because between the pandemic and the different issues around climate change, particularly here in California, the fires and the erosion and soil issues that we're going to be having here after those big fires are contained, it really is going to be something that we'll need to be able to pivot on, meaning that the tribes may realize that there could be an issue, but they may not know the scope of the issue. And once they find out the scope of the issue, there will need to be immediate attention to the issue. And of course, that itself is a project. And so the next priority is to provide the type of support and training that's required to bring a team together to address those kinds of issues. So you're going to need teams that can deal with planning and get refreshers on planning. You're going to need basic training for tribal leadership who may not understand what planning is about or what tribal transportation programs are really faced with. So you'll have to have kind of a basic toolbox of training topics that will get everybody up to speed with a quick response that can get them in a position to address at least the first round of needs. You know, these will be long-term needs as they go through, but at least to get themselves in a position to identify what those needs are and then identify funding sources and teams and people that they will need to have in place to address them. And I think the third issue is really that networking. The one thing that we know, at least with respect to the TTAP programs, is that networking among tribal transportation programs is essential. Given the chance to meet and talk with other people who are facing similar challenges under similar circumstances is an incredible opportunity for tribal transportation personnel. They will learn from one another how they're dealing with certain issues, whether or not projects can be funded by certain sources. You know, they'll have ideas, they'll be able to have discussions that will result in new ideas and how they will manage moving forward. And building those relationships is a great opportunity. I always enjoyed the idea of being able to talk to the tribal transportation program leadership and finding out what they needed. I always thought having a great relationship with them did us both a lot of good, but it's their relationship with one another, I think, that resulted in the most value.
I, for one, am very curious to see what comes out in the way of an RFP. I'm very hopeful that lessons have been learned through the pilot that sought to consolidate everything into a national model. Pilots are just that. They're to test things out And I think most of the consensus I have heard around the country is that the regional model is the way to go. And I hope that the priorities that you've identified with me today, Kelly, are baked into that effort, and that that sets the stage for some of these more ambitious goals for mobility and equity in the future. I'd like to thank you for your time today. It's been a pleasure speaking with you as always, Kelly. And I am hopeful that this conversation can be followed up upon in maybe a year's time, and we'll have some positive outcomes to talk about.
Thank you, Tyler.